Politics Wednesday here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, joining us today with political analysis of recent day developments. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
Jim McCormick is with us in our Ames studio, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Lots to chew through this week. We hope our listeners will also join our conversation on any number of topics we'll look at this hour. Note this number if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or leave a message or question on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Let's start internationally. Gentlemen, less than a day after a ceasefire seemed possible, Israel is warning tens of thousands of Gaza residents to leave their homes ahead of some fresh strikes. Airstrikes that followed this warning were targeting Hamas leaders. Gaza officials say the homes of four senior Hamas leaders were attacked and dozens of rockets were fired at Israel from Gaza. So this is continuing. I think this is day nine of this latest war between Israel and Hamas. Israel suffering its first fatality of the fighting yesterday. In Gaza, the death toll far higher, more than 200 people killed, according to Palestinian officials. Any hope of a ceasefire, or was there really no hope there, Jim, to begin with?
Well, you know, the Hamas obviously rejected the ceasefire yesterday that was brokered between by Egypt with the Israelis. Part of it was the reason, I think, was that they, you know, given the government now in Egypt, which is not really friendly to Hamas, it's a military-controlled government, Hamas, I suspect, read that as not being very much in their interest. I was struck by at the top of your newscast that you said that Secretary of State Kerry was going to be meeting with the vice president and the president on trying to move towards a ceasefire, and I was trying to contemplate how can the United States effectively intervene, you know, here in terms of getting a ceasefire, given that, you know, Hamas, at least officially by the U.S. government, is recognized as only as a terrorist organization. And obviously there's considerable pressure to provide support for Israel as an American ally. So it's really a dicey situation, it seems to me. One of the things that struck me as possible that might come about. Hamas has had some good relations with Turkey, if not with Egypt. So maybe the Turks could be involved. And given that the United States has obviously a NATO alliance with Turkey, that might be one sort of avenue to get a ceasefire. As well as Israel, over time, of course, has had at least workable relations with Turkey as well. But I think it's very dicey for the Israelis to stop. I mean, obviously they see themselves in a situation where they have been really very successful. And, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu has said they're not going to stop until the rockets stop. And those have not ceased yet. So, you know, the upper hand here is with the Israelis. Mm-hmm. And the United States is not, seems to me, in a strong position to get a ceasefire between the parties.
Rockets have not stopped. I think somewhere, Israelis saying somewhere around 1,000 rockets thus far. But, of course, the Gazans suffering much more.
Absolutely.
With all those casualties. It's very lopsided there. Tim Hagel, your thoughts.
I heard a national security advisor, former national security advisor, not that office, but somebody who advises in national security issues, Katie McFarland, said, if I can remember how she phrased it, that Israel uses missiles to protect people, whereas Hamas uses people to protect missiles. And that's one reason why the death toll is so much higher in terms of civilians in Gaza, and why, as indicated at the top of the segment, that Israel issued the warning saying, look, we're going to try to get these missile places and try to warn the people to get out. But from Hamas's point of view, that they like to use the civilian deaths to try to put international pressure on Israel. And the characterization of the situation as dicey is really accurate, because it's just one of those things that it's a very difficult situation to try to resolve in any way.
Mm-hmm. Does that international pressure, does Washington feel that international pressure due to all the civilian casualties in Gaza?
I suppose they do to a certain extent, particularly given President Obama's view of the situation and how he has handled international situations in the past. But on the other hand, it's a tough situation because he really wants to resolve it so that it doesn't come to the type of situation where suppose Israel does feel that it has to attack in a more than just the airstrikes, either a ground assault or something of that nature, and that would somehow draw the United States in, again, to help defend Israel as an ally. And that's certainly something that President Obama doesn't want, and especially in that particular situation.
Israel warning tens of thousands of Gaza residents to leave their homes ahead of these latest strikes. I know we asked this question of you last week, Jim, but does Israel look more poised for a ground incursion? Does that seem imminent?
I don't think they want to do that at this juncture, given given the death toll that you talked about and given that they have been fairly successful here with some of these strikes, I guess, against these missiles. Although what's unknown here, at least unknown to me, is the number of missiles that Hamas has access to it. On your comment earlier, the U.S. is feeling obviously some pressure simply in a humanitarian on a humanitarian level. But Hamas has not rallied the Arab world to its support. I mean, it's been rather deafening the response of other Arab countries to that. And I was just noticing a poll the other day that came out. Even within the Arab world, the support for, say, Hamas or Hezbollah, for example, has actually been on the decline. And even within Gaza,
why would that be?
Well, because they're suffering greatly. I mean, they're so landlocked. Gaza is landlocked. It has been cut off from easy access to Egypt. The Israelis have closed the border as well, and so jobs and the economy are greatly suffering here, and so you can see why having these particular rulers, which Gazan. Member was interviewed and said, he can't speak out publicly against this Hamas government for fear of some sort of retribution. But clearly he was disenchanted with what the Hamas government was doing.
Politics.
Running government. Running Gaza. Excuse me.
Excuse me, Jim McCormick with us on this Politics Day of Iowa State University, along with political scientist Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Join our conversation as we discuss not only Israel and Gaza, but a variety of other political issues, national and international. 1-866-780-9100. Mark is with us in Dubuque. Hi, Mark. Listening to this conversation, what point do you want to raise?
Hi. My point is, it seems to me Israel has a great military that should be very accurate with its arsenal, but it seems to me that they're killing a lot more Palestinians than they should be, and Hamas, who's firing rockets into Israel, only seems to be killing very few Israel civilians. So the question is, why do we support Israel if they're murdering innocent Palestinians?
Thank you, Mark. From Dubuque, Jim, would you like to tackle that one?
Well, first of all, a couple things. Part of the reason that some of the missiles from Hamas have not struck in Israel, of course, is because of the so-called Iron Dome, which actually the United States, along with the Israelis, supported. This is a way to knock these missiles out of the sky as they are coming in. I think the other part, why are we supporting? The explanation is that Hamas, given that the Gaza Strip is very closely populated here, heavy, dense population here, and in fact Hamas is in fact locating some of their missile attacks in civilian areas, and that obviously makes them vulnerable to these kind of responses by the Israelis. The Israelis would further argue that they did not start these attacks. The attack was started by Hamas against Israel.
Okay. Thank you for that question, Mark in Dubuque. Let's dovetail into a national and international development that we've also been following for several weeks, the border crisis on our southern border. More than 52,000 children have been caught crossing the United States border alone since October. It's double last year's number. President Obama calling the surge, in his words, an urgent humanitarian situation. Lawmakers calling for hearings on the crisis. A few points of the timeline as of recently. President Obama urging Congress earlier in this month to authorize $3.7 billion in emergency funds to bolster security, hasten deportations, deal with the humanitarian crisis in Central America. Congressional Republicans pushing back, saying that the border crisis is a result of Mr. Obama's policy problems and lax enforcement at the border. Republican lawmakers pushing to amend a bipartisan 2008 law signed in the waning days of the Bush administration. You mentioned this last week, Jim, currently making it difficult to return the children quickly to their countries. House Speaker John Boehner says Republicans hope to unveil a bill to deal with the border crisis by the end of the week. All kinds of people weighing in here. Pope Francis saying migrants around the world are subjected to racist and xenophobic attitudes. He wants the tens of thousands of Central American children crossing the border to the United States to be welcomed and protected. How do you see this changing our immigration debate? Let's start with you, Tim Hagel.
Well, it certainly puts a immediacy to it that we didn't see before. Although, having said that, certainly it's been an issue that has been discussed for quite some time in various levels, and having to deal, of course, with the millions, whatever figure is, there's different figures are thrown out, millions of people here that are not legally here for one reason or another, extended visas or what have you, and they have to be dealt with, and that's something that both sides haven't come to any agreement on, and even within specifically the Republican Party, they can't necessarily agree on what to do.
Any agreement declared dead for this legislative session.
This session. So, but now this puts an immediacy to it, because here you have thousands of children right now that have to be dealt with, that they're in these camps and not very good conditions, better conditions probably than on their trip to the United States, but they have to be sent to various locations, and there's some resistance to that. Now you're starting to see more of a pushback that initially it seemed to be something that was going to be a benefit politically. And you hate to think of the political side to this, but there is one. Politically would help the Democrats, but now you're seeing a number of people push back on that, saying, well, look, it's one thing to say, okay, if we have this crisis, we can deal with it and move on. But the problem is if you say, well, with this 50,000, we'll accept them and they'll be here and probably won't be deported, well, that sends a signal to others who may be interested in coming to the United States saying, well, let's do this too. And so dealing with the symptom versus dealing with the problem, and again, there isn't a whole lot of agreement on how to deal with either one.
Jim McCormick.
Well, I noticed that yesterday the Washington Post and NBC News had a poll that basically everybody's unhappy with the way that this has been handled by the Obama administration or by the Republicans in Congress. The public really wants some action taken, and it is really a complex kind of situation that we have. I mean, we have kind of development questions in Central America. We have border security questions. You have this kind of, as you mentioned, Pope Francis talking about the humanitarian imperative here. And so how do you bring these all together? And one of the things I think the American public, and maybe myself as included, frustration is that there has not been any kind of decisive action taken by policymakers to come together. I mean, obviously there are these kind of divisions that are there. Hopefully that we can get some kind of a measure which tries to broker all of these things in terms of protecting, say, the border of the United States, but also looking after the humanitarian needs of these people. I mean, we just cannot, as a society, it seems to me, and speaking from my own personal view here, shun these people aside. I mean, I do think it is important for the Congress to change the law to make it easier to return some of these people to their homes. And that will send a signal in terms of border security. I think that is an appropriate way to go. But in the short term, you also have to deal with this humanitarian crisis.
And when we talk about border security, correct me if I'm wrong, Tim and Jim here, but these are not people trying to sneak into the country. They come and put their hands up and run to the border guards.
Yeah, they want
to want asylum.
They want asylum, and that's going to be the tricky part. Even in the proposal that has been advanced, is to reduce this, you know, by Representative Cuellar and Senator Cornyn from Texas have put this proposal in place here that they would reduce this kind of review time from to about 10 days, seven days to have a hearing and 3 days for the magistrate to make a decision on whether these people should have asylum or should be retained or should be returned or whatever. I think that is even going to be tricky to enforce, just simply the mechanics. Even if they hire, as a proposed legislation, I think it said 40 new magistrates. That to me doesn't sound like a very large number in terms of the kind of crisis that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. And the repercussions of this also echoing down into our very own state this week. The news, Governor Terry Branstad telling Sylvia Burwell, the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services, he does not want children who are fleeing to the U.S. from this violence in Central America to be housed in Iowa. By the way, no children fleeing Central America have yet come to Iowa. Connie Ryan Terrell of the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa answering that, saying that many in Iowa's faith community are disappointed with the governor's decision since the state has a history of welcoming immigrants. She pointed to the 1970s. Governor Robert Ray, a leading governor in the country, working to provide some safe refuge for people coming from Southeast Asia in the wake of the Vietnam War.
And that's – it kind of gets back to the point I was making earlier where it's one thing if you had – we'll say, okay, 50,000, we can deal with this number. It's a lot. But if that's the number, people can go to various places, whether it's with family or to foster homes or whatever it happens to be. But it's not just that 50,000. Now we're back to the border security question. And I saw Governor Branstad's full comment, and he expressed empathy for this. He said, look, we feel for these. We understand the humanitarian aspect to this, but there are rules in place, and that basically, yes, the particular law right now is being followed, but it's being exploited. That, as it sounds like you folks discussed last week, that it has to do with child trafficking for sex trafficking purposes.
Yes,
but
Jim brought up that 2008
because
bill.
Of the way that it works, that children from not Mexico or Canada but from further away, that they have to go through this much lengthier process. Of course, even speeding up the process, as you were just mentioning, is going to require a lot of resources that Republicans are balking at to a certain extent because they want to see, well, okay, we can deal with this problem now or this symptom, the children that are here now. What about in the future if the idea is that they think people will still be able to come? And so it's kind of a long-term problem that the Republicans want to also see addressed. And, of course, that makes it more complicated to get something done.
There's one other dimension here, or a couple other dimensions. I think Tim is right. You have to have this sequencing. It seems to me before some of these states are going to accept people that are really refugees, there has to be something done to say that this is not going to be a kind of continuous flow that states will have to deal with. I think the second point to make is that, you know, when Governor Ray and laud him for his work on this. These were Vietnamese refugees. These were boat people. These were really people fleeing from kind of dangers that they had. Now, is this an analogous situation in Central America? Well, some would say, you know, there's violence, there's gang violence, and so on. I think the issue is, are these really refugees or are these, economic kind of immigrants that we're seeing. Maybe there should be no difference between them, but I think policymakers are probably going to make a distinction between those two.
Chris is joining us from Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100, currently talking about the border crisis, how it's changing the immigration debate in this country, along with other topics. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. I don't know if, Chris, you wanted to jump on this present discussion or another question.
Everything's all tied together economically. The drug war, economics, foreign aid, foreign policy, it's all related. And nobody ever addresses the real problem is foreign aid. It doesn't work. It's not worked with Israel. It's not brought peace to that area. We've given millions and billions of dollars to South America. We have NAFTA that was supposed to prop them up and help them. Yet we go in and we install bad leaders, and people get exploited, and this is what happens. I don't understand that Mm-hmm. You know, am okay. I the only one that?
Okay, let's get some reaction to.
What are American interests? American interests don't exist. It's interests of others, and I just.
Yep, I'm sure you're not the only one feeling these frustrations, Chris. We're going to get some reaction to you to your frustration, Jim McCormick.
Well, you know, this is sort of typical in terms of foreign assistance. I mean, foreign assistance to work usually takes a very, very long time. I would disagree a little bit. I mean, certainly one of the things that happened in the Middle East with we've provided lots of assistance to Egypt and Israel over time. Those have been the largest recipients of American aid. But we did get peace between those two countries, and it did bring. I'm not completely settled, obviously, but it did provide some sense of stability. I think the other thing in terms of Latin America, how much we can do in terms of providing assistance and a transition for these countries. I mean, that may well be part of the package that the Congress should look at. I mean, foreign assistance is not popular really across the political aisle here because of the problem, as the questioner or as the commentator suggested here. You know, you don't see immediate results here, and that is often frustrated to Americans because Americans want really quick turnaround.
Do you know, we've got a minute or so left, but do we know if our foreign assistance has been rising or lowering due to our budgetary situation?
It's remained pretty much stable in about the 25. Again, what you fit into that the account, but about $25 billion. So it is, you know, we still maintain this role as the largest contributor to assistance around the world. But actually, South America has been sort of some weaning off of assistance because we want to go in different directions here in terms of producing development there, in terms of trade and investment.
Okay, we want to take a short break and then come back with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, as we get some analysis on the recent political developments. We're going to move on from our immigration border crisis debates and move on to a new poll actually out just today showing that Joni Ernst now tied with Bruce Braley in the race for this open Iowa, U.S. Senate seat in Iowa. We want to talk about that when we come back. That's making national news, that new poll, both of them at 43%. If you'd like to weigh in on that, please join our conversation. Also want to talk probably about highway funding, Hobby Lobby legislation being born of that landmark decision from the Supreme Court. Chris Christie coming to Iowa. That's all yet to come as Politics Day continues here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we continue with Politics Wednesday, we have Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, fielding also your questions and comments at 1-866-780-9100 on our Facebook page. We're asking a question that we want to get to briefly at the end of the program based on a Mother Jones article, looking back at some interesting research done by a Professor Hibbing, John Hibbing of the University of Nebraska, talking about, your belief in your politics, your type of politics is in part because you are have a certain personality. You have a certain psychology, and even traits like physiology and genetics may play a role. We want to ask about that. Look at our Iowa Public Radio Facebook page and weigh in on the question we have there. But first, let's talk about it. The closely watched Iowa Senate race between Republican Joni Ernst and Democrat Bruce Braley. They are now locked in a dead heat, according to a new NBC News Marist poll showing that Ernst and Braley each have 43% of registered voters' support, 14% of the voters undecided about who they're going to support in the race. We are just less than 4 months ahead of the midterm election. About a third say they are unsure about their opinion on the candidates or have never heard of them. Tim Hagel, does this mean Bruce Braley is in trouble now that Joni Ernst has pulled side by side by him in the polls?
Well, it wouldn't say necessarily trouble. It certainly means that the race is a lot more competitive than what many people thought it was going to be as much as a month or 2 months ago, something of that nature. I do say with any of these polls, you have to have a fair bit of caution. And even with the NBC Marist poll, I looked at who they called, and the split that they had was something like 31-32% Democrats and Republicans and 37% no party voters, which was way too high, especially for a midterm election. I took a quick look at 2006 and 2010, and no party voters made up only 25-26% of the electorate that turned out. Of course, it's not necessarily the pollster's fault, because at this point you may not know, well, who is a likely voter, who is going to turn out, and so forth. So the big thing on this is to take a lot of these polls with a grain of salt, and both campaigns need to realize that they're in a tough fight, going to have to work hard for the victory.
This week, Joni Ernst delivered the GOP weekly address, highly critical of Washington, she said, that is full of liberals who think government is a solution to every problem. She echoes the familiar sentiment that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is making the health care industry worse and that we need to start over with health care reform. She also touched upon government programs, Social Security, Medicare, and public schools. Let's listen to a section of Joni Ernst delivering the GOP weekly address this week.
We believe we must preserve and protect Social Security and Medicare and keep our promise to today's seniors. But we also believe, as do some of our friends in the Democratic Party, that these programs must be reformed so America not only keeps its promise to today's seniors, but is also able to guarantee a safety net is available for our children and grandchildren. We believe strong schools are critical for the future success of our nation. I send my own daughter to the very same public school that I graduated from. To strengthen local schools, we believe we need to take power and money away from Washington politicians and bureaucrats and give it to local parents, teachers, and administrators so they can decide what's best for their children's education.
Joni Ernst delivering the GOP weekly address. Jim McCormick, what do you think of this rapid rise of Joni Ernst? And this is the latest step, a great honor to be asked to deliver the GOP weekly address, something reserved for GOP rising stars, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, and I think the Republicans obviously see that this is a possibility that they can succeed in this race, and giving her this high profile, it further enhances her, I think, her position in terms of the race. So, yeah, it is. It really is a reflection. I was really quite surprised and stunned when I was driving and I heard this on the radio, and I thought that was her voice. I didn't hear the introduction, and I just happened to hear a clip of this, and I said, oh, wow. So she has really moved up, and I think that obviously the Republicans nationally as well as within the state see that she is now in a very competitive position. And I think the use of the poll, that even if even with all the problems that the poll has, that she's come to this kind of even state gives further impetus to her campaign, it seems to me.
Before we move along, throw in what factors. It's plenty of time, an eternity in political terms before the midterm elections. Tim Hagel, what factors will decide this race in your mind in the coming months?
Turnout. Seriously, as much as we've heard in the past where even President Obama mentioned this, how, oh, Democrats don't vote in midterms. Well, as I've said before, that's not necessarily true here in Iowa of Democrats, that generally there is a bit less turnout for both Republicans and Democrats, and particularly for no party voters in midterm elections. But still, Democrats and Republicans turn out pretty well, Republicans a little bit more than Democrats. But it's still, they're so close that it's going to be those no party voters. And so each campaign has to do as much as it can to reach out to their own base, but also those no party voters and maybe some from the other party as well, and try to reach them on these issues. And one of the things that's interesting about the Ernst clip is that, some of these statements are things that Democrats could say, too. It's always the how do we get there part of it as to where the parties disagree.
Mm-hmm. Anything other than turnout for your words, for the factors deciding this race in the coming months, Jim?
I think the negative ads here, which really relates to this. I mean, I've been struck how negative the ads on both sides. And, of course, these are outside, mostly outside PACs that have been pouring money into Iowa to either attack Braley or to attack Ernst here. And that obviously interacts with turnout, because we do know that people get turned off, with these kind of negative ads. That may bring out the base voters to some extent to support their particular person, but what it does to those independents is to probably leave them at home. I think there are a couple other things, if I can just throw it in. I think one of the things that Ernst has to do yet, and I think the debates will be very important for her, because she's got to be able to demonstrate that she can stand up and talk about some of these national issues. That is not what she's been doing. Obviously, this radio address gives her a start on some of these positions. And I think given sort of Braley's missteps with regard to his sort of Iowa connection, if I can call it that, he's got to sort of resurrect that he really is tied to Iowa and interested in Iowa. So I would see those factors, too, as coming into play here in this race. And finally, I think this race has to be, has the chance of being the premier race. I thought the governor's race would sort of lead the pack in Iowa, but it looks like the senatorial race. I'd be interested in Tim, who follows this more closely, which will be the sort of the premier race in the state.
You agree this is the premier race ahead of the governor's race, where Jack Hatch is lagging well behind the governor?
You know, it's an odd thing, because I think Jim's right in that this is the Senate race is the one that most people are going to watch, but having Branstad at the top of the ticket makes it an important race to help Ernst, actually, in terms of her race.
Let's talk quickly about a couple of other items that have sprung into the news politically this week in response to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of Hobby Lobby, the one that ruled that some for-profit corporations may refuse to provide health coverage to provide for contraceptives if the employer has religious objections. Senate Democrats are pushing a bill that would upend the ruling. California Senator Barbara Boxer co-sponsoring a bill calling it the Not My Boss's Business Act bill. It has 45 Democratic co-sponsors in the Senate so far, unlikely to pass. But here are some words from Senator Boxer.
We shouldn't be embracing decisions that make it more difficult for women to get access to birth control. We're going to see if our colleagues agree. Every senator must take a stand for individual liberty. Women are watching. The American people will hold each of us accountable if we fail to protect their rights.
And meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has the GOP legislative answer, a legislation introduced by him and two other senators, Kelly Ayotte and Deb Fischer, both Republicans, that would protect Americans' religious freedom while preserving women's access to contraceptives. Jim, everybody is claiming the mantle of religious liberty here. Right.
Right. I think what they really want is a campaign issue for November. They want to vote in the Senate. So they've got these competing bills, and members that are candidates that are running for office can point to they would support one bill or the other bill. And again, this would be as these midterm elections are about in terms of getting the base out. So I think these are not really legislative pieces that are going to become law, but these are pieces that are going to be good campaign fodder.
Tim, the GOP wanting with Mitch McConnell's action here, along with the other senators, to head off an issue to head off the reawakening of this refrain from the Democrats of the war on women.
Yeah, it's one of these. I'm hesitating because it's like, okay, which side of this do you want to talk? As far as what Barbara Boxer was saying, Senator Boxer, yeah, they want to try to use, as they successfully did in the 2012 election cycle, the war on women theme and so forth. And as a result, they're sort of mischaracterizing what Hobby Lobby decision actually indicated, since the Hobby Lobby company only was concerned about 4 out of 20 particular drugs. So it's not like they were denying birth control. But then you get into the idea and say, well, you know, it shouldn't be your boss's decision. But, well, if you're forcing your boss to pay for it, then that means you have to take into consideration your boss's rights, too. And then we're to the McConnell stuff, where the religious freedom thing. And so you have kind of a clash of rights, religious freedom from the First Amendment on one hand versus right of privacy and including decisions of birth control and health care on the other side. And ultimately, that's where the stuff ends up being in the courts.
Elsewhere in politics, late yesterday, the House passed a short-term bill to fund federal highway programs through May of next year. It now heads to the Senate. White House officials are warning earlier in the week before that passed that nearly 700,000 jobs could be jeopardized if this highway trust fund runs short of cash. The fund pays federal shares of road and bridge constructions around the country. And President Obama, hoping for a more long-term solution, voiced his frustration with Congress during a speech at a federal highway research lab outside of Washington earlier this week.
At the very least, Congress should be keeping people on the job who are already there right now. But all this does is set us up for the same crisis a few months from now. So Congress shouldn't pat itself on the back for averting disaster for a few months, kicking the can down the road for a few months, careening from crisis to crisis when it comes to something as basic as our infrastructure.
Michigan Republican Dave Camp, who authored part of the plan, says there is no time to debate a long-term solution.
State transportation departments have already started delaying or stopping certain highway projects to prepare for the fact that funding may fall short. Americans across the country deserve to see less gridlock on the roads and from their elected representatives. These policies are straightforward and have a history of bipartisan, bicameral support.
Okay, that's the history, Tim Hagel. But why have this bicameral, bipartisan support broken down at this particular time?
Well, I think Representative Camp is right to a certain extent that doing this right now, a month before all of this is going to happen, doesn't give you the time necessary to both figure out what to do that's going to cause both sides to come together on this, and then also sell it to the public. Because to the extent, especially to the extent that it may cause an increase or a different calculation of the gas tax, right now it's, 18.4 cents per gallon, and that's what it's been since 1993. Well, okay, are you going to tie that to like a sales tax to the price of a gallon? Are you going to tax it at the refinery? Are you going to, you know, move things around? Well, all of that, it's going to take time to sort that out. And especially in an election year, that's a tough thing to do.
Jim, your comment.
I would agree. I think the election is an important consideration here. We don't know what the composition of the new Congress would look like, particularly what the Senate would look like. And I suspect that is also part of the members of Congress calculation here in terms of getting this more short-term kind of bill. I think it's very important, and both Democrats and Republicans would agree, that to maintain these 700,000 jobs. I mean, President Obama, of course, has had a long-term goal here in during his presidency is to get more spending on infrastructure here. And I think probably the Republicans want to have a better say as they look to 2015 in shaping any kind of infrastructure spending.
Tim Hagel, Chris Christie, Iowa bound for a three-day tour of fundraisers beginning on Thursday. The first, the New Jersey governor has visited Iowa since he stumped for Mitt Romney outside of Des Moines before those 2012 presidential caucuses. Christie, not ruling out a White House bid for 2016. What's the purpose of such a visit, a year and a half before the Iowa caucuses?
Well, a combination of things. One, of course, is to come in to support Governor Branstad, who's appeared a fundraiser for him, and his two Republican governors that, you know, get along, that you expect those kinds of things. But, of course, this is Iowa, and if we have caucuses, and Christie has been mentioned previously as a presidential candidate. In fact, there were some Iowans that famously went to New Jersey in the last presidential cycle to try to get Christie to enter the race when they weren't entirely satisfied with the field at that time. So it's no surprising that when Christie comes here that people start talking about the potential of a presidential run, and that's kind of what people do. And we've seen this. Christie's been here, Santorum's been here, Paul has been here, and they'll come in, and it's a combination of testing the waters but also sort of getting to know the people, the players in Iowa, getting a feel for what the caucuses are like, particularly for people that maybe don't have an Iowa connection, that don't understand, well, what was the process, why do you have to go around and meet people and show up at all of these diners and so forth. And it works pretty much the same way in New Hampshire as well. And so you kind of get a feel for that and do some favors for people that maybe then will do favors for you if you decide to run for the presidency.
I know, Chris Christie, in light of this tour taking some hits from conservative groups, a three-day online campaign by the conservative group Judicial Crisis Network, time to coincide with this visit to Iowa, saying that he has made deals with Democrats on judicial appointments. So taking fire from conservative elements in the Republican Party.
Oh, absolutely. And that's been one of the criticisms all along, is that maybe he wouldn't be conservative enough to either compete in Iowa for the caucuses. And of course, we'd certainly like to see him come to Iowa. We don't like people that skip our state. But either beyond Iowa, is he going to be conservative enough to get the nomination? Even if they think he would be, if they can get the nomination, would he be competitive in the general election? So there's sort of that off stumbling block, so to speak, is that you have to win a primary before you can get to the general election. But, you know, on the other hand, if you're the governor of a state like New Jersey, which is fairly Democratic, you're going to have to make deals with people from the other side. And so in that sense, Christie could always tout it as his bipartisanship.
Three or four minutes left, Tim and Jim. Before we go, I want to throw this out to you on a completely different side of the playing field here in politics. A statement from a recent article in Mother Jones reminded us that it was about 10 years ago that we had this sort of spin on people's political views. The title of the article, "Scientists Are Beginning to Figure Out Why Conservatives Are Conservative," taken from the article, I'll just read, "A large body of political scientists and political psychologists now concur that liberals and conservatives disagree about politics in part because they are different people at the level of personality, psychology, and even traits like physiology and genetics." Now, I wanted to bounce this off of the two of you as political scientists, not necessarily political psychologists. But go ahead, Jim. Do you think that there is that political scientists are more and more concurring that some of these things, traits that we are born with, perhaps even our genetics, make us predisposed to having conservative or liberal views?
Well, I think, you know, this is the classic kind of nurture-nature kind of argument here that we often go through. And lots of work has been done in political science, you know, at sort of beyond the individual level, sort of at the aggregate level and sort of the opinion level, but not really, if you will, drilling down into individual personalities and traits, you know, because as the article makes clear, this is pretty difficult to do, and you know the kind of experimental data that they use then is sort of is it really isomorphic with what people have in terms of their political views? I tend to think that Hibbing and his group are onto something here.
John Hibbing, the author of the paper which started this off some 10 years ago. Yeah. Incidentally, Tim, you pointed out before the program, he received his PhD from the University of Iowa back in 1980. But go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, so I think he and his group are really onto something here in terms of that there are certain kind of traits here. One of the things that immediately struck me, though, is how much are these a result of some of the things, you know, the kind of environment that we find ourselves in. I mean, the article sort of at least downplays, you know, how we were socialized by our parents or, you know, by our friends. And others would say, well, it's really when you go through that critical socialization about the sort of the 17, 18 year frame that leads to this. And what he's saying that this starts much earlier. And I guess that's where my question mark remains. I tend to be of this older generation that thinks some of these critical events at a critical time in people's lives are really what shape some of their political attitudes here.
Tim Hagel, less than a minute for you to give your thoughts on this. No, that's fine, Jim McCormick.
Two quick things, and I think Jim was sort of getting at this, is the idea that, you know, which comes first, the socialization or the particular viewpoint? And it's kind of that caution that we always have to worry about in social science is that correlation is not the same as causation. The other point I would make is that there was initially resistance to a lot of these studies, mainly because they always portrayed conservatives in a bad light, and that this study seems to be kind of getting away from that, trying to take a more neutral approach, which then seems to suggest that maybe that we can look at this more even-handed if we can get the politics out of it.
Okay. Tim Hagel and Jim McCormick. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you both for joining us for this Politics Wednesday, and we'll look forward to having you back in the future.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on this program, a program you'll not want to miss. We've started this up last year and very popular among listeners. We've heard plenty of feedback about this. We'll look at cases before the Iowa Supreme Court right now. For instance, raising questions like, if your license plate frame, the thing around your license plate, covers the county on your license plate, can the police pull you over? the Iowa Supreme Court ruling on that. And can you run for public office if you've been convicted of OWI, operating while under the influence? Well, to find the answers to those questions, please do tune in tomorrow as we look at the entire hour at questions before, cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. In Ames, help today from Garrett Van Leeuwen, the executive producer of our talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.